Hello and welcome to this very edition of the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. Later on, we'll hear from comedian Maurice Gahan on the business of acquiring vices. And Jennifer Walsh contemplates this year's Pride Without a Parade. But we're starting by spending a little time on TikTok. Honestly, just a couple of videos. 2 a.m. How the hell did that happen? The addictive short video sharing app TikTok won surprise attention last week when a group of its users claimed to have caused disruption in the ticketing for Donald Trump's Tulsa rally. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later in the program, but the app's awesome powers are not limited to political dark ops. TikTok has also an increasing role in how the global music industry functions. I asked the music and technology researcher Sherry Hu about the influence, commercial and musical, of TikTok.
TikTok is a short-form video app, I think is the simplest way to put it. Any user can download TikTok and start posting their own short-form videos. There's a lot of different like editing and captioning you can do on your videos. One major differentiator with TikTok is that sound and music both play a really important role. A lot of the most popular content on TikTok revolves around music, around whether it's like dance challenges or people just putting a song into really interesting and really funny contexts. I think one really fascinating element of TikTok that I think will have an influence on pop culture in general is the ability of so many people to tell a story in such a short amount of time. Like if you only have 10 to 15 seconds, what's the most interesting narrative you can put together? And you see that in, I guess, the musical snippets or excerpts that gain the most traction. Usually these songs have some kind of drop. A lot of these challenges involve, you know, very unexpectedly or surprisingly changing your look or like changing the kind of dance or activity you're doing from 1 second to the next. What musical elements best serve that? The classic, you know, drop in EDM is really good for that.
So when you say drops are important, can you explain that to people who don't know what a drop is?
The concept of a drop is particularly common and popular in the world of electronic dance music. The interesting thing with electronic music versus pop music is that there isn't like a verse, chorus, you know, verse, bridge, chorus structure. It's mostly kind of periods of low energy that's building up over time, followed by like very sudden drop into very high energy section. And so like what a drop means is that it kind of, yeah, builds up a lot of energy and then kind of all the energy is released into the super, you know, like high energy, upbeat, very, you know, very percussive kind of section of release. That isn't quite a chorus, it just refers to, yeah, the levels of energy. So that's what I mean by a drop. I guess just a release of a long buildup of energy over time.
You were using the word challenge, and we know these originally, I suppose, off Facebook, where people were sort of challenged to throw a bucket of ice water over themselves. But that's developed into its own kind of subculture on TikTok, where it's about a conversation. One video talks to the next, and a style or a movement or a choreography develops and gets inflected by different people as it grows.
One small but really important part of TikTok's interface that makes it different from something like YouTube is that you can see like precisely how many videos have been made using a certain sound clip. And it's quite easy. This is probably why TikTok is in more serious licensing talks with all the rights holders in music, is that you can quite easily trace, you know, where the sound featured in a certain video came from and then like co-opt that for your own video in a much easier, smoother way than if you were to do that on YouTube. You'd have to somehow figure out what the song is and then download it and then edit it into your own video. I think, yeah, TikTok centralizes that creative process a lot more smoothly.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse through the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna
take the story of Old Town Road is so fascinating and like just like checks off all the boxes of a really interesting like breakout story about someone who like was relatively unknown but who just happened to be really savvy with social media, creating the song, this kind of like tongue-in-cheek song just for fun in a way that combined country and hip-hop in this very, you know, tongue-in-cheek way that people hadn't really heard before, intentionally using dance challenges as the primary marketing vehicle. Even if, you know, only 10 seconds of a song were included in the video, it ended up getting a lot of viral traction. And that was also one of the first examples of people actually being really interested in the song because it wasn't a sound they'd heard before. And so then going to Spotify, Apple Music, and other streaming services and actually streaming the song in full. And then, you know, a major label like Columbia Records noticing Lil Nas X and then signing him to a deal that then went on to break, you know, history on the Billboard charts. Given that TikTok is relatively new, I think we haven't really seen any kind of trajectory like that, at least like from independent to major label history making artist in a matter of a year.
We are starting to see songs following that path, songs used in a TikTok challenge, and then they go overground. There is something to TikTok like an alternative radio station or a college radio station in that it somehow deals in things that are not part of the mainstream marketplace.
It is more and less powerful than traditional channels like radio. I think it is more powerful in that the forces that determine what go viral and what become the most popular are very much bottom up rather than top down. And by that, I mean, in the wake of Old Town Road, so many major labels are trying to incorporate virality as a marketing strategy, which seems almost like a lost cause because it's really hard to control or even predict, you know, whether something will go viral. But they have to create a TikTok campaign or like a branded hashtag challenge for people to take part in on the app. And then they'll launch it and maybe pay some influencers on the app to do the challenge and promote it to their fans. And so it might get some traction, but it usually dies down within just, you know, a day or a couple of days at most.
Does the way TikTok works begin to shape what people decide to make or release as music?
Oh, absolutely. I've already heard in a lot of conversations, people are using the phrase like TikTok record. How do we make a TikTok record? How do we make a TikTok song? I don't know if that's like the most effective way to think about it. I think this is just the latest step in a pattern throughout history of artists molding their songs to the most popular technological formats of the time. What I think is especially interesting is that the unit of focus is even shorter because the TikTok video is not 3 minutes long. So if you're trying to maximize virality in some way on TikTok or your chances of going viral, you really only have to think about the specific earworm that you want to be promoting, like the specific 5 second, 10 second lyrical and musical hook. A lot of people have differing opinions on whether that kind of enhances or reduces creativity, but that is very much a reality in terms of how artists are thinking.
A lot of the time, the predominantly white user base in TikTok will use black music and often lip sync to black artists. And there has been a certain amount of pushback that this is a kind of a digital blackface in the way people ask white users not to use black GIFs, because there is an element of digital blackface to it.
Yeah, I totally agree that there's like a similar issue. I think in the specific instance of using GIFs that feature black people, I think that is more like visually clearly an example of digital blackface because you are passing off this image of black expression kind of as your own, and you're attaching it to your own words that you're, you know, saying or posting online. Whereas with TikTok, I guess it's a similar issue, but one level kind of peeled back because the disputes that have come up around crediting black artists or using their ideas or creativity, it comes from a dance. It's not, you know, taking an already existing clip and kind of passing it off as your own or your own expression. It's taking a dance, which as far as I'm concerned, can't be copyrighted, which is a really tricky issue, especially with these kinds of apps. It's taking a dance and passing it off without acknowledgement of its provenance. I think that's the main issue. The dance move that was at the center of this kind of dispute recently was a dance called the Renegade. Renegade, 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 Renegade.
go, 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 go,
which a 14-year-old black girl named Jalia Harmon made actually first on Dub Smash, which is a competing short-form video app to TikTok, and has a largely black audience, I believe, black Americans specifically. That dance somehow translated to TikTok, which, yes, many of the most popular clips, at least in the US, are featuring white people. And so they just take the dance, let it go viral, and they don't mention this girl at all. And this is definitely a downside of this notion of ceding control and of just, you know, letting people do what they want. After a while, with the help of the internet, this original girl finally spoke up and even like met with some of the original creators on TikTok who went the most viral, who were white, and like made a video with them, finally got the credit she was due. But this is a story that comes up again and again in terms of like really popular facets of culture and of dancing originating in black communities and then not being credited.
Go, 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 let's go. Wait.
Sherry Hu there on TikTok's impact on the music industry. But as well as giving the industry a bit of a scare, TikTok, working with a cohort of fans of K-pop, that brand of pop music synonymous with Korea but popular throughout the world, has become something of a scourge of white nationalists. I hope you're paying attention down the back there. I asked our regular tech correspondent Aisling Kelleher about TikTok and K-pop's recent ventures into political activism. Over the last few days, there's been a bit of debate about what exactly happened at the Tulsa rally of the President of the United States. It seems to have been underattended, and people are rushing with explanations for that, including the fans of Korean pop bands and the users of the TikTok app. Do we believe either of them, Aisling?
Well, I've been thinking about this a lot because obviously on one side we have the Trump administration. And so straight away there, we have a big question mark about believability about anything that they say. So that's on one side. And on the other, we have a rationale being offered for why perhaps up to a million so-called tickets were sold to this event to a venue that can hold 19,000. So initially it was very much Brad Pascali, the kind of organizer of this for the Trump administration, was thrilled with this event and looked like there was tremendous interest. And then, of course, the venue was about two-thirds empty. So what you began to see was this trumpeting almost on TikTok and on Twitter by these large groups, these kind of armies of K-pop fans who had really done, or claimed to have done anyway, a bit of a digital hit on the whole event. In this case, what they were doing is signing up for tons and tons of tickets, and they obviously had no intention whatsoever of going to the event. This also gained some popularity from another woman who's in her 50s here in the United States, who also put up this idea on TikTok.
Basically a Karen.
Her little video about this has been watched and viewed over 700,000 times. And this is quite a sophisticated hit because it started several days before the rally, where these armies of legions of fans went ahead, set up like fake phone numbers or used Google Voice over IP to gain a new number, quickly bought the tickets and then immediately deleted, or very soon after, deleted their posts so that the Trump administration would have no indication of what was coming.
The thing about this group of people, the K-pop fans, this is a type of pop music that looks deeply apolitical. It's very highly produced, very commercially orientated. It doesn't seem like a natural breeding ground for activism.
Yeah, I think the activism is something that is really kind of embedded in this really strong culture of fandom. The fans for the K-pop groups are extremely loyal, extremely active on social media platforms, and are very, very good at doing very rapid organization. So they are routed in, like I said, this very dedicated loyalty to their fans, which means they really do take offense. They might even just take offense to what you just said about this kind of apolitical or very overly produced or commercial type of music. But then over the summer in particular, we're seeing a whole slew of different events that K-pop accounts on Twitter initially and also now on TikTok began to get involved in. So, for example, this is very much tied into the Black Lives Matter movement and different events around this. So one example would be the Dallas Police Force decided to create an iWatch Dallas app, where people could, if they had seen any type of activity that they thought was maybe suspicious or something going on with any of the protests, they could upload the content using the app. So in response to this, K-pop advocates were pretty annoyed about this and felt that this was something that's a surveillance type of instrument. And they began to download the app and then just flooded with videos of their favorite idols, idols being the members of the K-pop band, to the extent that it made the app completely useless. And the Dallas police had to kind of wrap that up and stop using that. So from this initial success, we begin to see they realize that there's other targets that they might want to look at, not just necessarily police force, but also those who might be objecting to or trying to spread disinformation about Black Lives Matter. So then we begin to see a hashtag war, essentially, where the K-pop fans decided that they would begin to co-opt some of the hashtags that those on the extreme right, the alt-right white supremacists, were trying to get going, whether that's something like White Lives Matter or even All Lives Matter. And beginning again, same strategy, flooding that with videos and content related to K-pop idols. Just there's so much noise in the signal that it would eventually suppress the ability of alt-right accounts to get their message out there.
One of the effects of this has been to throw attention back onto what is K-pop itself. You know, not just people like us saying, well, what is K-pop? There's been a certain amount of pushback from African-American academics and observers of African-American culture and Black culture.
Correct. I think there's some very interesting academics out there, like Miranda Lawson, who's at the University of Tokyo, and Dr. Laurie Morimoto, who's here at the University of Virginia. And they're very active on Twitter as well, drawing attention to some of the more kind of complicated issues around the kind of the appropriation of Black culture by K-pop groups, or the misappropriation of it as well. And also the kind of the way that these groups, in their tremendous loyalty to the K-pop groups themselves, do not take very kindly to people of color pointing out the problems in some of either the costumes that people wear, the type of wear that they speak, or the type of way that folks in K-pop groups, you know, style their hair, for example. And there's been numerous accounts and events over the last couple of years, you know, some of them even quite recently, of K-pop groups, you know, using blackface or speaking in a kind of like a fake African-American accent, as if it's, I mean, it's something that you try on and that's kind of like fun without any thought or anything whatsoever about the significance and the trauma that has been done to African-American people over centuries. So there is a little bit of pushback to saying, like, yes, on the one hand, this is good because a lot of money has been raised from both K-pop groups and K-pop fans for, say, advocacy groups like Black Lives Matter. But at the same time, there is really problematic things, not only with the bands themselves, but in the fans. This is where I think academics who've been studying K-pop as a type of fandom in all its complexity over a considerable amount of time, such as Dr. Morimoto and Miranda Larson, really draw out some of the nuances here. You know, that this seemed to be just kind of like trying on this type of activism, doing it for a while, getting a lot of praise for that, and then just kind of moving on and not having to necessarily do the hard work on the ground. 'Cause it's a fake alert, fake alert.
Aisling Kelleher there on TikTok activism. And if you're interested in hearing more on the prehistory of activism in fandom, follow us now on Twitter at CultureFilePod, where we'll tweet links to our previous interviews with the pioneer ACCA fan, USC's Henry Jenkins. Now we return to a farm somewhere in County Kilkenny, where we find comedian and writer Maurice Gohan, now free to go, has been contemplating vices and how we acquire them, from box sets to sweets and sticks.
I'm still living on my boyfriend's family's farm. I've been here for 3 months now. I've only been going out with my boyfriend for 7 months, so that's a fairly outrageous ratio. I do kind of like it though, living with his parents and brothers. It's kind of quaint. Feels like olden times. Mainly because his father keeps shouting, "Where's my bloody dairy?" when I walk in the room. It was that same father's birthday last weekend. My gift to him was a 6-pack of Coke and a packet of Milkados. And he loved it. He screamed in happiness. He's a sugar addict. He's not a big drinker. He doesn't smoke, but he can neck a tub of ice cream like nobody else. Sugar is his thing. If I gave him a choice of 10 more years of life or a 99 cone, I'm pretty sure he'd pick the 99. Vices are an interesting thing. Does something need to be inherently bad to be a vice? No, otherwise there wouldn't be limits on treadmills during peak hours. Of course there's exceptions, but the exception proves the rule. By saying, I don't eat meat on a Tuesday, it implies you eat meat on the other 6 days. Some vices are bad from day one, sure, like heroin or Westlife's music. But most things are okay initially. So when does something go from an innocuous thing you enjoy to a vice? A glass of wine a day is good for you, but a bottle a day will kill you. Exercising will prolong your life, but exercise for 6 hours a day and you'll end up in the hospital. A bar of chocolate gives you dopamine, but 20 bars gives you heart disease. So is a vice just something fun you do to excess so it stops being fun? If so, where's the tipping point? There's a dog on the farm called Grizzly, and he's obsessed with sticks. All he wants is to have a stick thrown. It's taken over his life. You could throw him 50 sticks, and he still wants more. Everything he sees is a potential stick. It's ruined his relationships. You can't pet him or tell him he's a good boy without him presenting a bloody stick in front of you. There was probably a time when a stick was a fun, exciting thing for him. But now he's defined by it. It's taken over his life. He might know what the tipping point was, but unfortunately he's a dog, and dogs can't talk. So I need to look further inwards to figure this one out. A week ago, I started watching a new show on Netflix, The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. It's a reality show about rich housewives in Beverly Hills and their champagne parties and fights over lip gloss. I watched the first episode and I loved their Botox faces and 85 carat rings. I loved that they spent more on an Easter egg than I do on 3 months' rent. Excess will always be thrilling to me, and watching women argue when they can't move their faces is better than a James Bond film.
All right, Lisa, don't do crystal meth in the bathroom all night long.
Bitch.
Same.
Do not put your finger in my face.
You're going to get my finger in your face, too.
Listen. No. Stop it.
You know, you don't know what's going to happen, but it's going well.
So I came across this show and I thought, oh, lovely. Some trashy TV I can watch now and again as a distraction, a way to unwind from the day. Now I'm watching 6 episodes a day. By 10 a.m., I'm 2 episodes in. I yell at my boyfriend when he comes in the room and interrupts me watching the girls. My fun distraction has become an obsession. When the internet cut out, I screamed so loud people thought I had hurt myself. I need to know how Camille is handling the divorce with Kelsey Grammer, I shout as dinner is called. Who's going to get the Malibu house? What was the turning point? When I started following one of the girls' personal chefs on Instagram? When I asked my boyfriend's mother to pick up some caviar from Dunn's. When I considered giving myself a nickname of Gal About Town. I don't know. The problem with turning points is you can't pinpoint them. It's an oxymoron in a way. Less a turning point and more a turning vague idea. No one can pinpoint the drink that turned them from a good time party guy to an alcoholic. The piece of cake that gave them diabetes. Maybe that's the excitement of it. Us all tiptoeing the fine line of enjoyment and vice, wondering which step will be the one to ruin us. One man's virtue is another dog's vice, Grizzly barked to me today as we contemplated it all. Now throw that bloody stick before I bite through the electricity wires. Thank you.
Maurice Gohan there, contemplating throwing the stick. Pride this year has faced the choice of postponing, as Cork Pride has, or going online, as Dublin Pride will do on the weekend. But that, as composer and artist Jennifer Walsh has been thinking, is not quite the same as dancing in the streets.
It's late June, which means it's time for Pride. A time to celebrate the LGBTQ plus community, to drink cocktails while watching the late June sun set on streets strewn with glitter and rainbow-coloured confetti. But Soho is boarded up, and nothing is open. Pride is digital now. Pride comes at the end of the academic year, which means it should mark the end of the stress of term. But right now, everyone I know who teaches at a university is deep in the midst of long discussions about how teaching will take place in the autumn. It's fairly clear that some, if not all, of teaching will happen online. And many first-year students will take online classes from their family home, still sleeping in their childhood bedroom at a time when they thought they would have finally moved out. For many of my queer students, their university years are the first time where they can be their authentic selves without fear of bullying or violence, without the fear of family members rejecting them. University is also where many queer students discover gender studies and queer studies, where they learn to articulate their experiences, where they learn to take pride in their journey. The best universities, and by best, I'm not talking about academic ranking here, I'm talking about the universities with the most heart, provide a safe space where queer students can express themselves, where they can come out without fear, where, in the words of Dan Savage and Terry Miller, it can get better. So this pride, this new digital pride, I'm thinking of my queer students. I'm thinking of past students like H, who for their dissertation wrote a coming out oratorio that brought myself and the rest of the committee to tears. I'm thinking of my students whose pronouns, names and gender shifted over the course of their degree and the honour we had to support them in that journey. And I'm thinking of future students, students I haven't met yet, the ones who will start their university years online. The students who might have to wait a little bit longer for it to get better. Happy Pride, class of 2024. Stay strong. We know you're there and we're waiting for you.
Jennifer Walsh there on Pride in the Pandemic. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more partially compensatory jollity next Friday at 7 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.